Good afternoon. We're obviously all gathered here for today's debate on an issue that social and legal issue that has divided and vexed the courts for almost literally half a century. The continued use of race in admissions programs, narrowly, broadly, the continued efficacy and legality of affirmative action. The topic, of course, has garnered new attention as a result of the Supreme Court's grant of cert in Fisher versus the University of Texas, in which the plaintiff claims that the, quote, race-based admissions program, end quote, at the University of Texas violated her constitutional rights. Today's debate will be between Mr. Connolly and Professor Ford Mazarui. I'm going to state the question so it can be answered in the affirmative and the negative. And so the question will be, should the Supreme Court overrule its opinion in Grutter versus Bollinger, a 2003 opinion, and should it then outlaw the continued use of affirmative action in legal education? Stating the positive case will be Mr. Connolly. Stating the negative case will be Professor Ford Mazarui. I've told them both that they will each be given 15 minutes to state their case, and then that will be followed by 5-minute rebuttals by each, and then we will throw it up for questions. Without further ado, Mr. Connolly.
Well, thank you very much for inviting me to come to your beautiful state and to discuss this very contentious issue, but it's one that we have to resolve in our time, I think. The courts have been very gradually trying to move toward a solution, each time falling short of that. Race is something that is very personal. There are many ways that we can enter this discussion. We can discuss it from the standpoint of the law, the Constitution, socially. But I think that the most relevant way is to discuss it from our own personal frame of reference. I was born in the Deep South in 1939, Leesville, Louisiana. My father left the house when I was 2, and my mother died when I was 4. I was raised by a maternal aunt and her husband, Uncle James. And they're the people that shaped my life, my views. Uncle James never got beyond the third grade, but he was a fiercely independent man who believed that every person was in fact an individual, and that nobody gave you anything. You had to earn your way, and that you do unto others as you would have them do unto you. And that sort of shaped how I come at the issue of race. Not only race, but identity and how we view other people. That blossoms over into my view about sexual orientation, gender, all of those things are shaped by my view that we're all individuals and we need to be treated as such by our government. My views are not guided by private transactions as much as they are about our government. Every April 15, the government demands of us tithe, and I think that it has a duty to treat us as individuals. I was sentenced to a 12-year term on the Board of Regents of the University of California in 1993. And I learned something about the university system of what some call affirmative action, but which I came to view as race preferences. Visualize a matrix. Going horizontally, we have a number of points that we allocate. Vertically, we have the people who belong to the different 5 food groups, black, white, Latino, Native American. Latino is even broken down into Latino and Chicano, born in Mexico, and others who are not born in Mexico. And the points are anywhere from 0 to 5,000. The difference between what a white student or an Asian student gets in being and applying to the University of California and what one of the underrepresented minorities would get at Berkeley is as much as 1,000 points. 1,000 points makes the difference between a C minus, 780 on the SAT, and 1180 and a B plus. That's the difference. That's the magnitude of the race preferences that we were being allowed at the University of California. I happened to be in my second year when I learned about this. I was chairman of the Finance Committee which is the Major Oversight Committee, and I thought that we were a lawsuit waiting to happen. But more importantly, I concluded that treating people differently for admissions was just wrong. It's wrong for our society to do that. As I indicated when I began, Uncle James said, treat everybody the way you want to be treated. What I learned was that we weren't doing that. At the bottom of every document, it said the University of California does not discriminate on the basis of race, sex, color, ethnicity, religion, sexual orientation. And I concluded that all of that was just a lie. We were discriminating. We were calling it diversity. We were calling it affirmative action. But in my book, it was just flat-out discrimination. And I believe that that was wrong. I felt that the university should not be engaging in that kind of conduct. So I proposed to my colleagues that we prohibit the use of race, ethnicity, national origin, all of those factors that we said we would not discriminate against people on the basis of. And I also included in that resolution a requirement that we use supplemental factors, use income, use class, use whether a student had ever had a parent go to college, use all of those factors. Look at the schools that they attended. Many of those schools don't have honors courses. And so therefore, it's almost impossible for someone who attends a school that doesn't have advanced placement courses to be competitive with someone who does attend a school like that. At Berkeley, we have 51,000 students apply every year. We could fill every class every year and never get below 4.2. The school I attended, Grant Union High School, it's impossible for you to get above 4.0 because we don't have honors courses. So I said, take that into account. I want to see access provided to the largest number of people as possible, especially at a public institution. But race is not something that we earn. Race is not something that we earn. Coming from the Deep South, I believe that based on my own experience, coming from a multiracial family of Irish, of African descent, of Choctaw Indian, French, don't hold that against me, but of all those different factors, I just felt that the University of California should live up to its finest ideal of treating everyone as an equal. The Grutter decision turned everything upside down because it said that diversity was okay to be used in the context of building a university classroom. I believe diversity is nothing more than an excuse to discriminate. It defies the Civil Rights Act of 64, which says that we will all be treated as equals, as my friend John Rosenberg often says, without regard, not because of, but without regard to those factors of race and ethnicity and national origin. Why the Supreme Court doesn't acknowledge that and treat us according to the law without regard to those factors, not because of them, but without regard to them. In my own state of California, where the population is changing so rapidly that you can change, we can look at race every year and have a different mix of students. So I don't see how, from a practical standpoint, we can ever build a class that is diverse by taking race and ethnicity into account. One of the things that happened once we eliminated race preferences is that the number of underrepresented minorities at our more selective institutions declined in that first year. No question about it. But that's a reflection of the magnitude to which we were using race. After that, the underrepresented minority population, and I hate that term, but that's the one that the university uses, it has gone up. And the graduation rate is higher. And the students are not mismatched, as you often hear a lot about now, based on race. We're a nation of ideals, folks. We're a nation of ideals. And I think our finest ideal is that we're individuals. And everybody should be accorded the right to equal treatment. That is a civil right. When we talked about civil rights back in the 60s, it was not so that people could be treated differently. You know, if you told me back in 1962, when I graduated from college, that we'd be standing here 50 years later talking about whether the University of California or the University of Virginia or any other public institution should be discriminating against a young Vietnamese kid to build diversity, I'd say that you're out of your mind. There's no way that we will ever reach the point where this nation will betray its most fundamental ideal and discriminate against people when we've gone the road, traveled the road that we have on the basis of race. We should know better than that. We should know better than that, and we should live up to our ideals, as Dr. King said, live out the true meaning of our creed. And our creed is not one in which we treat people differently as members of some food group in which we have to sort out people and subdivide people into these different groups. I'll tell you that I personally would like to see us abandon the practice of even asking people, what is your race? Nelson Mandela once said that that is a inhumane practice. And I disagree, and I agree with that. We should not be subdividing our people in this country into different racial groups. It's wrong. We're all individuals. We're not white and black and all of those different classifications that the government wants to assign to us. The census is slowly getting it right. They're beginning to allow multiracial identity. And in California, I can tell you that with 100 and some languages spoken in the LA school district, and with people representing different groups, makes no sense. So I just want to say to you that I think that we're on the precipice of a defining moment in our country, which the court will, I believe, strike down the use of race or ethnicity for purposes of building diversity in a college setting. Thank you again for inviting me to be with you.
Thank you to Mr. Connolly for coming to visit us, and thank you to Federalist Society for holding this important program. My remarks I'm calling today, Taking the Constitution Seriously. With regard to Abigail Fisher versus the University of Texas, I'm going to right now make a prediction. You heard it here first. It will be a divided opinion with Kennedy in the majority. Now, we could go into some of the details of the program, but as Professor Johnson asked, should the court overrule it is a larger question, and I suspect the court wouldn't take it just to discuss, you know, differences between the 10% plus plan versus Michigan's plan. It's probably looking to return to the question anew. So that's what I want to address in my remarks today, and I want to make three points. First, if the court takes the Constitution seriously from an originalist perspective, they should uphold the plan. Second, if the court uses non-originalist but nonetheless recognized approaches to constitutional interpretation, they should uphold Texas's plan. And if the court were to do what the Federalist Society and many would abhor, which is engage in rank moral or policy guised as constitutional interpretation, the court should nonetheless uphold the plan. So on the first point, originalism, I want to take a page from the Federalist Society, which takes the Constitution seriously. The Federalist Society is known for advocating a return to first principles, such as the Constitution's text and its original meaning, as well as reminding the judiciary to have a healthy respect for its role, its judicial restraint, the importance of state sovereignty, and the importance of the democratic process. These principles point in the direction of upholding the plan. First, the text. The term equality in the Constitution, or equal protection, is what's at issue in this case, not the Civil Rights Act, which, as Mr. Connolly suggested, is more explicit about race. That applies to the employment and other settings. But here we're talking about the Constitution. It just says equal. Equal does not require identical treatment. And here there's a conceptual mistake in Mr. Connolly's distinction between treating us equally and preferentially. Equality can require preferential treatment. In fact, equality can require it. Equality requires treating people who are similarly situated the same, but it requires people treating differently if they're differently situated. It's a principle of reasons. We need to know whether the distinction that all laws and policies make, all laws discriminate, are based on relevant and legitimate criteria in order to decide whether it's treating people equally or not. Originalists know that, and that's why they advocate looking to original meaning, because the term equality is too open textured to provide adequate guidance to restrain the courts. But if we look to original meaning, there's no affirmative case, and the burden would be on those who challenge the constitutionality of the products of the state political process to show that those policies conflict with the text or original meaning. And that burden cannot be met. First, there's just silence on the issue. There's mostly silence just on the issue of elementary and secondary school segregation and the like. But there's even greater silence on the question of the role of race in higher education. We can also look then for indirect and circumstantial evidence. The 39th Congress passed remedial laws, such as the Freedmen's Bureau, to help the freed slaves. Many of these laws were race conscious, including laws that provided subsistence to destitute colored women and children. We also know the 1866 Act, which was the forebearer of the 14th Amendment and what it was intended to uphold, does not address education. It addresses things like property ownership, contract, sue and be sued, inheritance. Those were the civil rights that the 14th Amendment was targeted at. It does not mention education. Also, we know the 39th Congress, and indeed for the next 30 years, funded white affirmative action in higher education. Schools across the entire country had 100% quotas for white males, and Congress provided funding to these schools to establish new land-grant colleges, and states continue to engage in white affirmative action or in public universities. So it's even less plausible that they would have intended to forbid race as a plus factor to benefit the very group that the 14th Amendment was intended to benefit. If we look to state practice, again, as evidence of what the original meaning was, again, they reserved not only the flagship schools, but the overwhelming number of public schools to 100% affirmative action for whites. So turning to the non-originalist versions, first, the most conservative, though non-originalist, is traditionalism, looking to tradition. And there simply isn't a deeply rooted tradition prohibiting affirmative action. Indeed, the practice itself didn't emerge till the late 60s and 1970s, and it wasn't prohibited under law until the successful efforts of Ward Connerly and his supporters in banning it in the late 1990s in a few states since. So there isn't a deeply rooted tradition. Another methodology that's even less conservative is evolving consensus. We saw this in Lawrence versus Texas, an emerging awareness. Scalia calls that an oxymoron, to call that a tradition if it's emerging. But even looking at that methodology and the objective signs, I think, is it five or six states, depending on how you count Florida, have now banned affirmative action. That still means the great majority of the states still allow affirmative action, and the federal government, in fact, more states allow same-sex marriage than prohibit affirmative action. I think it's implausible to claim that same-sex marriage has reached a national consensus. So finally, political process theory, which is incorporated in a lot of the doctrine about strict scrutiny, discrete and insular groups. It's just implausible to claim that whites are a discrete and insular minority needing special protection from the judiciary. So the final category of arguments then is to turn to morality-based arguments that race discrimination is wrong, or affirmative action, or race preferences, whatever term, And I respect that people can legitimately and strongly believe that it is. But I want to suggest that, on balance, the argument is contestable. I will even argue that, if anything, morality favors affirmative action, but at the very least, it's sufficiently contestable and uncertain that it lies outside the competence of the courts to decide and should be left to state experimentation. And the claim I want to make is that the very premises on which opponents of affirmative action base their argument support a case for affirmative action. I want to mention three principal premises. First, that race discrimination is wrong, and implicitly that affirmative action is a form of race discrimination, which I accept. Second, that corrective justice requires that the victims of wrongful discrimination be made whole. So first, discrimination is wrong. Second, corrective justice theory. And third, that race is a necessary part of correcting the injustice. And this may be less intuitively obvious to you, so let me explain what I mean by that. When someone like Abigail Fisher or Barbara Grutter sue public universities to claim that they've been discriminated against, a required element of their case is to claim that they are of a race that's not one of the preferred races. They claim that they are Caucasian in their lawsuit. Indeed, Barbara Grutter's complaint says, on behalf of a class of Caucasians and other non-preferred groups. In other words, it's even a group-based claim. And Abigail Fisher is Caucasian. That's part of the element. And the court has to make a finding, implicitly or explicitly, that the complainant is white, as evidence that she's been discriminated against by the university. So taking account of race ends up being a necessary part of remedying the discrimination. These principles support affirmative action as well. America, and more currently as passionately, talked about the injustice of the past. America engaged for many, many generations in egregious racial discrimination against African Americans. That discrimination plausibly explains, in large part, the dramatic racial disparities that have persisted across all social and economic indicators of well-being in our society since before segregation was abolished. I could go into that, but the statistics in every category are significant: health, education, etc. So, race discrimination is wrong, and African Americans were harmed by it and continue to experience the harmful consequence. Second premise, corrective justice. American society owes the victims of its discrimination to be made whole. And finally, that race is a necessary part of that. If you're going to rectify the consequences largely manifest today in socioeconomic disparities that disproportionately burden African Americans, a critical element to identifying who those people likely are is taking account of race. And that's if you're talking about remedial affirmative action, which is what I'm emphasizing. Although one can make the same point about diversity, if you want to bring in the experience of people living in the society who are members of different racial groups, the most effective way to bring in people who have had those experiences, whether it's the experience of discrimination or a cultural experience, is to take account of race. So if anything, the case creates a moral dilemma. Race discrimination against African Americans requires under justice to be rectified, but engaging in it also results in race discrimination against present members of society. So there's a moral dilemma at the very least. But isn't this two wrongs? Two wrongs don't make a right, surely. Well, let me make some further points in response to that. First of all, a continuing wrong is inevitable, even if we assume that affirmative action does implicate the questions of justice. There's no way to avoid doing something wrong by avoiding affirmative action. And that is because inaction is not morally neutral. That is to say, if we say, well, you know, racist discrimination was wrong, let's move on, let's not do that anymore. But if that means that you lose the most effective ways to remedy that past discrimination, then you're committing a moral wrong under corrective justice theory. Corrective justice theory says it is a wrong to fail to remedy a wrong. That's the point of the corrective justice aspect of it. There is a duty to rectify a wrong. So doing nothing or doing something that's not ineffective actually continues the wrong of the existing harm from past discrimination. So two wrongs don't answer the question either. Also, if there are two wrongs and we're weighing them, well, what are the two wrongs? The wrong against African Americans, much longer in time, much longer in scope, much longer in effect. When it's systematic and society-wide, that's what leads it to have intergenerational effects. And worse in purpose as well, based on white supremacy and invidious attitudes. Affirmative action, in contrast, even assuming that one can criticize it as, again, implicating moral concerns, the purpose, even if you disagree with it, is much more benign. It's not based on invidious white supremacy, whatever you think about affirmative action. It's much more limited in scope and effect as well. Someone who's denied a job or admission to university because of affirmative action, in general, means they go to a university of their second choice. Often it's a comparable university. It doesn't mean they're shut out of all universities. Indeed, Abigail Fisher is attending another about to graduate, from, I believe, from another university. Even weighing the two wrongs, the wrong against African Americans, which corrective justice says needs to be rectified, is a worse wrong both in purpose, scope, and effect than the discrimination of affirmative action. And then the final point I make about this is that it's not even necessarily accurate to describe what happens to an Abigail Fisher or a Barbara Grutter as a discriminatory wrong. And let me be clear what I mean by that. I understand that in the specific act, one can characterize it as discrimination in a logical way. But I want to suggest that it's also a incidental and necessary consequence of remedying discrimination. And the same thing happens when you remedy affirmative action. If a Barbara Grutter or Abigail Fisher is seeking an injunction to be admitted to the university, they were denied admission. And some affirmative action cases seek that. Well, notice, by the time the courts get through with it, a couple of years has gone by, say they win, and that's what they're seeking, they are saying they have a right to the remedy of being ordered admitted to the school. Well, by that point, it's a couple years later, it would mean taking up a slot that could be awarded to another applicant who had no personal responsibility whatsoever for Abigail Fisher's earlier denial of admission. Yet that person doesn't get to go, in some part, because of rectifying the racial discrimination that occurred against Abigail Fisher, which takes her race into account in adjudicating that claim. And so in some sense, this person is losing out on a seat for no responsibility of their own because of a race-conscious remedy. So I understand there's moral considerations on both sides. But again, I would say that the complexity and empirical uncertainties in precisely how to best rectify historic discrimination in a way that adequately is effective and minimizes the cost to other parties defies a simple rule of colorblindness, and more importantly, defies the judicial competence of the Supreme Court if it's going to faithfully interpret the Constitution. Thank you.
I'm not smart enough to be able to process corrective justice and all of those things. I'm not a lawyer. Praise the Lord. I'm just an ordinary citizen who has to live among you in accordance with certain rules of society. And I would tell you that if Uncle James were standing here today, he would say, "Son, the smallest pancake has two sides. But you do unto others as you would have them do unto you." Affirmative action is a very amorphous term. It means different things to different people. But preferential treatment is pretty precise. The initiative that I've supported in California, Arizona, Washington State, Nebraska, Florida, which never got on the ballot, but still an executive order, New Hampshire passed it, says the state, small s, shall not discriminate against or grant preferential treatment to any individual or group on the basis of race, sex, color, ethnicity, or national origin in the operation of public employment, public education, or public contracting. 37 words, pretty simple, pretty direct, but it's a standard that we all live by. We should live by that. It says that no matter what our skin color, and if you looked around this room, you'd find people of every hue that there is. You'd find people who are, every one of us is diverse. Some of you have got lots of hair. Some of you are still growing it. But we're different. We're different. But we're all entitled to the same presumption of equal treatment. I understand what equal means. I don't need corrective justice for that. I know what equal means. It means you treat me the same way you treat everybody else. That's what we fought about in the 1960s. You can't redefine that, equal treatment. The court's gotten it wrong for many years, almost rightfully so, because they were trying to bring us from a point at which I was held to a different standard because of my color. In America, I'm a black man. People treated me differently. You know, when we were living in California, Uncle James's father died, and he had to travel back to Natchez, Mississippi. And Aunt Bert and Uncle James and I drove from California, from Sacramento, California, to Natchez, stopping only to go to a greasy spoon for a hamburger and knee-high soda. I love grape. Or to use the restroom. But the restrooms were all segregated, and Aunt Bert wouldn't allow us to use them because there was black, there was white, and there was colored. And the colored was always not well attended, not filled with toilet tissue or anything else. And so we would use a secluded road, not because we were barbarians, but because Aunt Bert refused to allow us to use them. I remember we were driving up to a service station, and Uncle James rolled down the window. It may sound foreign to you, but he literally rolled down the window then. There was no push button. The boy outside that waited on us said, "Hurry up, boy," to Uncle James. I knew something then about discrimination. Uncle James was amputated. His dignity was amputated because he was being treated differently. Using race poisons people. It breeds resentment. It does all of those things that we don't want to happen to someone in this country. We shouldn't be treated that way. That's what race does, and I think that's what the Supreme Court is going to process as they look at this question of diversity. So I would beg of you to start getting us on track, and I think the court will do that, to treat us as individuals without regard. I stress that, my friends, over and over again, without regard to race or color, not because of it.
Okay. Let me just make a couple points, and then I really want to hear from the audience. Mr. Connolly talked about, more using measures that would allow everyone to get an opportunity, and you've heard the president talk about lift every boat. Justice Thomas talked about increasing the size of the class as a remedy. That sounds good, lift every boat, but we actually have limited resources. If we're not going to just guarantee everyone can go to the University of Virginia or Harvard or even higher education. We just don't have the resources. So, I would imagine if you did increase the class of the school and limited those seats on the basis of race, that people wouldn't be happy. So unless you expand to include everyone, there's always going to be this issue of we're going to have to limit who gets in and who gets out. Second, I say this with respect. I completely respect your personal experience with your family, but I want to caution that that may have limited probative value for the question we're discussing. What we're talking about is statistical inequality that's millions of people across the nation. In every community across the nation, blacks are significantly worse off than whites. So it's not a matter of kind of specific individuals who do or do not take responsibility for their behavior. And individual experiences in life don't adequately explain why the disparities are so stark and widespread. That suggests that the consequences of historic discrimination are much deeper and structural. And I'm sure there are, and I know there are, many, many stories of people who have benefited from affirmative action that I also think we should be wary of giving too much weight. So I just think we should be careful about anecdotal evidence. And then the final point that I want to make is why sort of ignoring race is unlikely to help to close the gap. I, like Mr. Connolly, deeply believe in the inherent equality of black people and other racial minorities. And I will just assume Mr. Connolly also believe that white people are equal as well. And that means that I don't see why the gap should reduce if we give everyone, in a sense, a hands-off from here on out, you take the opportunities you're born into. Because historic discrimination has meant that, on average, white people are born into families and communities, families, nuclear families, family networks, and communities with significantly more opportunities. And they take advantage of that and work hard and study hard and take their AP courses and the like. That's all well and good. But on average, black children are born into significantly fewer opportunities. So to expect that the gap would close over time is to suggest that whites being born into and raised with greater advantages won't stay ahead. And the blacks will catch up starting from behind. And that assumes that, to use the metaphor of running, that blacks run faster. Or that assumes blacks are more intelligent, that they are going to catch up with less. And I'm sorry, I believe white people are equal to blacks. And so without taking account of race, I believe whites who are born in with greater advantage on average will continue to remain more advantaged unless we take race into account in order to increase disproportionately the opportunities to those who are born with less advantage.